The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week, are you ready to rock? In the first of a new series, our master of metal, Dom Lawson, tells us what we need to know about that particular area of music. We review new music from Massive Attack with Burial, Luke Haynes and Eleanor Freiberger, and as new box sets and collections abound, from The Smiths, Nirvana, The Beach Boys and The Who, to name a few, we find out how reissues like these come together from John Savage and a few others. That's all to come in this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. The world has been full of Apple and BlackBerry news this week, but it's a fruit-free zone on the programme. Apart from this lovely pair, that's P-A-I-R, our guest this week, Jude Rogers.
Hello,
how are you doing?
I'm right.
And the guides, Richard Vine, your first time.
Indeed, hello.
How are you doing? You okay?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. Later, in a new regular slot, our expert Dominic Lawson expands our horizons and takes us through some highlights from the world of heavy metal. We'll be looking at box sets, as we mentioned before, as well. Let's start with listening and reviewing some tunes. We'll begin with Jude's choice. Big Daddy got a Casio OBL tone. Big Daddy got a Casio OBL tone. And it turns him on. That's Luke Haynes. And Big Daddy got a Casio VL tone.
Which is the best name for a song.
It's
an
amazing,
surely.
Amazing name for a song. It's from his forthcoming album, which is a concept album about the golden age of British wrestling. Jude, you brought this in.
I did bring it in because, you know, when you're going through your stuff, you think, what could I talk about or what could we talk about? Probably an album called 9½ Psychedelic Meditations on British Wrestling of the 1970s and early 80s. I've been listening a lot recently to, I don't know, I seem to be coming across a lot of albums that just make me laugh.
Right.
And I remember reading a long cover piece in Wire magazine a couple of years ago about the value of humour in music, mm-hmm. which, strange enough, wasn't a very funny piece in the Wire magazine.
It's odd, because normally I find the Wire an absolute hoot.
Full of, you know, kind of gut-busting laughs.
A smile, a song, a funny little dance, that's what the
But,
like.
You know, there a lot of music that we listen to is, you know, a lot of Indian rock and even pop in some measures can be quite kind of, you know, I'm making a statement, I'm making a point, I'm doing all this stuff. There's not much playfulness, it seems, in a lot of music anymore. And I've been listening recently a lot to the new Half Man, Half Biscuit album,
uh-huh.
which is great.
Of course.
And, you know, Half Man, Half Biscuit, for those of you who don't know, brilliant satirist, really funny songs. You know, they sound the same as the songs they've been doing forever.
Yeah.
But this album, the Luke Haynes album, you know, musically, probably not. I'm not listening to as much, you know, he's a very talented gentleman, very funny lyricist. You know, listening to that, I was just laughing throughout because, you know, the sound of the very basic keyboards and the very basic sound.
It is a Casio VL tone.
It is, yes. But I think there's real, you know, we forget to listen to music that just makes us laugh and has lots of crazy ideas. And Luke Haynes is kind of, you know, quite fixated on the late 70s. You know, he's written stuff about the Yorkshire Ripper. He's written stuff about now wrestlers, obviously. And he's intent on kind of plumbing this, you know, his early years and kind of making quite entertaining songs.
I think he's interesting.
Yeah.
Somewhere. I mean, he seems to have one theme, and it's like the decline of England, I think. And he's been sort of hammering this theme for a long time, since, there was the fourth Auteurs album, which held until the
Blue Boys. Yeah, and then Black Box Recorder.
Black Box Recorder. And to a degree, there's a bit of that in the Bader Meinhof album as well. I'm a really big Luke Haynes fan. And I liked him. I liked Spawn. I liked his last album.
Oh, really? I loved the last album.
I thought the one before that was brilliant. Off My Rocker at the Art School Bop. The one which had the song about the Yorkshire Ripper on it. and had a song about Gary Glitter on it as well. I am an unequivocal fan.
I think that song, you know, playing that song was just, I just wanted to hear a song like that on the podcast because it's so completely bonkers. I can't say I love it musically. It makes me smile. I think there's value in that and people don't do that enough.
Okay.
There we are.
And there's real joy in it as well. Yeah. I think when you listen to the lyrics when he's talking about, you know, Rock 2, he's talking about the setting on the Casio VL-Tone.
Yes.
I remember having that keyboard. It was my brother's. You know, borrowed it many times. It's a brilliant piece of machinery. And I think, so drawing together those two sort of very specific elements of, you know, early 80s nostalgia, there is a lot of humour in that. And I think it's a funny song. I'm not sure I want to listen to it 100 times.
Yeah.
But it did make me laugh.
I'll offer a small prize. So we can name two other tracks that have got Casio VL-Tones in.
Oh, my Lord.
I can think of two.
Nobody,
anything?
There's them Da-Da.
Yeah, well, that's one of them. Da-Da-Da by Trio.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Man Who's Head Expanded by The Fall. There you go.
Oh,
turn that bloody blimey Space Invader off. That's Marky Smith says. Luke Haynes, Big Daddy, got a Casio VL-Tone. What's the album called again, Jude?
9½ Psychedelic Meditations on British Wrestling of the 1970s and early 80s. Say that with, you know.
Okay, fantastic. That's out now. Next track is My Choice. That's Massive Attack versus Burial, Four Walls. That track has been pressed onto a heavyweight 12-inch vinyl record housed in stunning hand-numbered gold glitter screen-printed sleeve designed by 3D. It's £25 a copy.
Wow.
Only 1,000 copies were made, and it's already sold out. You can hear it on YouTube. I mean, it's got to be said, if someone said to you, what do you reckon? A collaboration between Massive Attack and Burial with Mazzy Star Woman, what's her name?
Hope Sandoval.
Singing on it would sound like... Mm. I'd say it would sound like that, to be honest with you, you know? Doesn't make it any less beautiful, just because it's what you would expect them to do. And it's very, very long. It's 11 and a half minutes long. And in particular, the last sort of 2 minutes, it's supposed to stop and then starts again. The last 2 minutes are sort of hugely... I hesitate to use the word uplifting, but there's something very, very beautiful about the closing 2 minutes of music on it. And it just, I really like Massive Attack. I'm a fan of Massive Attack for many, many years. I'm a fan of what Burial does. There seems to be a sort of coming together of two kind of linked artists in a way, sort of aesthetically.
It makes you think about kind artists. There's a sort of... I hate something narrative because that sounds a bit
continuum.
Pretentious. Continuum between, you know, there's kind of that kind of you know, say going back to psychedelic stuff, but kind of this kind of psychedelic stream of kind of dance music that's gone through people like Massive Attack and is coming out obviously in the last, you know, kind of 5 to 10 years with, you know, dubstep and a lot of sounds have come from that. And, you know, it made me think of the Cocteau Twins and, you know, kind of bands that can fit into that, you know, and obviously, you know, Liz Fraser has
worked with
Massive Attack before, but kind of it made me think a lot of 4AD stuff as well. So it's kind of it's weirdly timeless, actually.
Yeah,
you wouldn't say it's necessarily from 2011, you know, would you? In a way,
well, I mean, it doesn't particularly sound like a sort of up to the minute dubstep track. I just think it sounds like a really beautiful piece of music. Mm. Richard,
I was actually listening to this on my way in this morning, and I played it at my computer when I was, you know, just sort of working the other day, and I found it. I was just drifting off and I kind of got bored, but listening to it on the train when I had nothing else to do, I think the sort of widescape, you know, the kind of cinematic scope that it ends up in. If you relinquish yourself, give over, just let yourself listen to it, really relax into it, then it's amazing.
Mm. I've always said like Burial's walking music. It is.
It's a really interesting idea because people, you know, if they have a criticism of Massive Attack, and indeed some people on the dubstep scene of Burial, they'll say, oh, well, it's coffee table dubstep, yeah, which implies that it's music you play in the background while you're having a dinner party. Whereas actually, I think you're right. I think it's music that you've got to kind of totally succumb to.
Totally, yeah.
And you can't really do anything. Or you, I mean, obviously, you're free to do whatever you want while you're listening to it. But if you do just have it on as background music, you will not get the full, yeah, psychedelic effect.
I probably, you know, wouldn't listen to Burial to dinner party as well.
Yeah. But people always say this. You're tricky. Tricky was background. But people always say Tricky was background.
You're a man
I'm going to stab you. Listen to that. So we all like it. We all think it's a good thing.
Great,
I think they should make a whole record together. Yeah. I think that would be a really amazing thing. I thought there was at one point, somebody charged less, yes. But it is a beautiful artifact, and it's produced by Vinyl Factory, who are the people who run Phonica and the magazine Fact. And it is a lovely thing. Mm. But I mean, it's hard lines, whether it doesn't really matter if it's a lovely thing or not, because they've all sold out now. Anyway, you can, as I said, listen to it on YouTube, and I highly recommend you do so if you have 12 minutes spare. Our last track is Richard's Choice. That's Elna Friedberger, or Friedberger, and Roosevelt Island. Richard, you brought this in. She's the singer of the Fiery Furnaces. People may know her. I mean, they may not. but, you know, they might. I mean, if they're aware of the work of the Fiery Furnaces, they may know from that. This is quite different to the music of the Fiery Furnaces.
Yeah, but I think it still has that kind of same kind of very literate approach to songwriting. I mean, just getting the words "designated corner" into a pop song is kind of amazing, and I think she's got this sort of very charming ability to, you know, say things like "you made me feel like I was more like you than me, I liked that," without it being too going into that kind of, you know, magic indie pixie kind of zone.
It's not very whimsical. I don't think the Fiery Furnaces were a particularly whimsical band either.
No.
Or are, I mean, they're still ongoing, aren't they?
I think so, yeah.
Mm. Well, the backing is a sort of pastiche of I guess, early 70s soul music.
Yeah, but I like that sort of, you know, having that stacked snare and that kind of the Clavinova bass line you don't often hear, and it seems quite a deliberate choice.
Is this indicative of the rest of her album?
Yeah, but this is by far and away the sort of perkiest, most uplifting song, and it's really sort of stood out to me when I've just had, you know, sort of various the sort of last month's, you know, tracks on.
Sure. I mean, I liked it a lot. I have history with the Fiery Furnaces. First album, Gallows Birds Bark, was probably my favourite record, I think, of 2003. I really loved that album. And I sort of hung out with them a bit and wrote a feature about them. And they were brilliant live at that time as well. Absolutely remarkable kind of sort of gigs. The fairly obviously. that's why you're good live, because you do good gigs. But then I completely lost my patience with them because their output became just torrential and increasingly unlistenable, I found. And just the melodic... I could understand what they were trying to do because her brother, Matthew, is a massive Who fan. And it struck me that everything they subsequently tried to do was a bit like A Quick One by the Quick One While He's Away, which was these songs that had like 18 different bits that seemed totally unconnected. That would the issue that I had with that is, what's brilliant about A Quick One While He's Away by The Who is The Who are this unbelievably tight band, and they can turn on a sixpence, and particularly if you see the footage of them doing it live on the Rock and Roll Circus thing from 1968, it's just breathtaking how they just apparently completely unconnected segments of songs, they just go bam, bam, bam into it. Fiery Furnaces were all over the bloody shop, so it just used to be a complete racket, and I just felt they'd lost what was good about that first album,
I think a lot of their songs seem to kind of, you know, they seem to lack any kind of original kind of ideas after a point as well. They seem to be doing the same sorts of things. Although I always liked her voice.
Great voice.
And I love this. I really love this. You know, I heard it a little while ago, you know, before this situation that we're in now, gentlemen. No, but I heard it. And I thought it's, you know, cause I didn't even hear the title when I first heard it. And I kind of thought, I can imagine this being a video in New York or whatever. I've been to Roosevelt Island. I've been on the cable car that goes over to it. It's a very odd little island because it used to be a leper colony or something.
Oh, is that right?
It's kind of quite a bizarre place. I think her vocals and the kind of that literate style, it can kind of get a bit grating after a while, and it did get really grating for me with Fiery Furnaces. Mm. But I think here, there's a bit of, I hesitate to say sass, but kind of like, she's kind of like, you know, you want to click your fingers to it and go, yeah. You
know? Yeah, no, totally, totally.
And completely embarrass yourself.
I think that was true of the first album as well. There was something about the first Fiery Furnaces album that had this real...
balls about it.
Ballsy kind of thing. And it was sort of intriguing record based around her living in, well, her travelling around.
Yeah.
It was like a diary for her. There's a lot of stuff about living in London.
This sounds very much like a diary when you sort of go through what she's actually saying. Mm. And it is just sitting on a train or a cable car, kind of just observing the world, thinking about stuff. And it almost sounds like she just scribbled it down and then she's singing it. And I think there's something really engaging about that. But for me, a little does go a long way. But this is the ideal 5 minutes of it.
Okay, well, that's out now. What's the name of the album?
It's called Last Summer, I think.
Last Summer, okay.
Something like that.
Last Summer, which is out now on Merge Records. Okay, just before Dom Lawson takes us through ongoing events in the world of metal, some comments on last week's tracks from the blog. Lots of love for Kieran Yates and her choice of track, Aluna George. It's a brilliant track, I think, actually. Martin Young said, fresh and vibrant and is exactly the kind of great and progressive R&B pop there should be in the charts. The rest of the comment was mainly about last week's interview with Peter Doggett, who's written a book about David Bowie. Punk Anderson said, I'll always stand up and defend Let's Dance. Will you? All right, okay. Of course it's not as groundbreaking as Ziggy or Lowe, if at all. But it's got mystique, it has Bowie and wonderful voice, it sounds great today, has cracking songs, overlooked ones too, like Criminal World. It's a cover. Actually, Criminal World. And it does have weirdness in the shape of Ricochet. Ricochet. To me, Let's Dance is magic. Good for you, Punk Anderson. I really like Let's Dance as well. Marvellous. Anyway, all comments and tweets are welcome as ever. The links are all on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly.
Hello, folks. My name's Dom Lawson. I'm a music journalist specialising in the thrilling and slightly disturbing world of heavy metal. I'm here to give you a little glimpse into the terrifying dark corners of the metal world. Right, we're going to start off with the new album made by Metallica, the biggest heavy metal band in the world, and rock legend Lou Reed.
I am a chorus of the voices. They gather up the magnets set before me.
The album's called Lulu, and it's an absolute fucking abomination. It sounded like a reasonable idea in theory that a massive rock band would make a record with one of their heroes, supposedly, and it makes sense that Lou Reed would want to make an album with Metallica and to do something dark and edgy. But sadly, the reality of it is, listening to the entire album, it's an absolute endurance test. Metallica sound awestruck and totally out of their depth, and Lou Reed is a mumbling old tosspot talking about sex and death for an hour and a half.
I have no morals, some think me cheap, and someone who despises the normalcy of heartbreak, the purity of love.
The way I'm describing this album makes it sound unspeakably awful, and it really is, but it's so awful that everybody should hear it at least once. Well, just once.
Upon the bin of lust, everything else bores me.
The next thing I want to talk about is the new Megadeth album, and Dave Mustaine was an original member of Metallica, of course, but in contrast to his ex-colleagues, his new album is actually really good. Megadeth album is called 13. It's absolutely the consummate modern metal record. Megadeth have proved over the last few years that they've absolutely stayed in touch with the sound of metal in the 21st century, and that they understand what metal fans not necessarily just hardcore metal fans, but in a broader sense, you know, mainstream rock and metal fans, what they really want to listen to. And so not just the production on the album, which is absolute state of the art as usual, but the songwriting on 13 is just absolutely top notch. They're short and to the point, these songs. There's not too much rambling, there's not a great deal of technical wanking or, you know, overtly complex proggy stuff, but it's just full-on 21st century heavy metal delivered with passion and integrity. It's undeniable that Dave Mustaine, even though he's a cantankerous old sod, has got his shit together and is really pushing Megadeth forward in a cool way. And so if you get a chance to hear 13 and enjoy it as much as I have, then definitely check out Endgame, which is the album that came out before, which is equally good if not better. With the enemies I've made, you might say despicable punishments reciprocal, public enemy number one. The next item is a new album that is going to piss off a massive amount of people. Sometimes I This is Korn, a track from the new album, The Path of Totality, which comes out later in the year. Korn are effectively the godfathers of a subgenre called nu metal, which polarised opinion at the time in the mid to late 90s and still polarises opinion now, even amongst metal fans, because basically it combined really heavy music, heavy riffs with rapping and kind of more modern elements. What they've done now is make an album where they've collaborated with a bunch of dubstep DJs. I mean, I actually think the album's fantastic. I think it absolutely rules, and I think for me personally, dubstep is the new punk rock, so I don't have a problem with it at all. But there's going to be a lot of hardcore metal fans who are be pulling their hair out and bursting into tears when they hear this record, because it's kind of contrary to the spirit of traditional metal in an almost kind of antagonistic way. But I kind of applaud that, really. I think Korn have got massive balls.
Well, I must say, I don't know about that noise, but I like the cut of Dom Lawson's jib. I'm very glad we've got... Just to explain why we're doing this, it's going to be a regular series of little featurettes, on the podcast, where we were sort of having a think. We thought there's a lot of areas of music this podcast doesn't cover generally, and it would be good to get experts from those areas of music in to talk about what's big, to sort of introduce us to a wider frame of reference. And I think Mr. Lawson has acquitted himself rather well. Lou Reed is a mumbling old tosspot. That is the kind of thing that I wholeheartedly approve of. People say music journalism's dead. I say listen to that and think again. Anybody, I mean, you know, heavy metal is a world slightly beyond, somewhat beyond my ken. Anybody here ever have, I've never had a metal phase. Anybody ever had a metal phase?
I've gone in and out. I'm a big fan of the sort of early Van Halen albums, for example.
Oh, not this again. We had that. We had Michael Hann on here banging on about the early Van Halen albums, saying they were more important than the Velvet Underground.
I wouldn't go that far.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
But I think, you know, there's a certain... I enjoy rocking out. But I think it's very hard being not up on the scene to... Apart from, obviously, you know, realising that Metallica have kind of lost their way by sucking Lou Reed into
I've heard that whole vortex. Album. It's an hour and a half of just misery... Oh, dearie me, it's awful.
I've never had a metal phase. Sorry, Alexis looks at me leadingly.
No, I don't.
And I just started.
I wanted to know. I wanted to know if you. I definitely.
No, I have not had a metal phase. I did have a metal fortnight when I was about 14. When Adrian Hughes from down the road brought me a copy of the Black Album to try and seduce me. It didn't work.
What a terrible way to seduce a lady.
I think he's trying to seduce me. Probably not. I don't know.
No, I think it's all brilliant, and I'm really glad we've got a bit of wider. Frame of musical reference coming into this podcast. So listen up. Finally this week we dip into the world of box sets and reissues. The long lost Beach Boys album Smile is out in just over a fortnight, and it comes in a variety of packages. A 2 CD set, an iTunes LP digital album, and a limited edition box set containing 4 CDs, 2 vinyl LPs, 2 vinyl singles, and a 60-page hardbound book written by Beach Boys historian Dominic Priore. The latter will set you back £117 if you buy it on Amazon, quite a dent in anyone's pocket. There's 8 Smiths albums reissued, repackaged to satiate the need. A little Smith reference there for you. By Rhino. And next month there's a Quadrophenia, massively expanded version of The Who's Quadrophenia. How do these collections come together? That's the question we've all been asking. John Dennis has been answering it for us. He's been speaking to Karen Simmons of Universal Music, Mason Williams of the Rhino label in the US. They both put together collections for their respective labels, as well as music writer John Savage. Love the Sav. Yeah. Who has put together a few compilations in his time too.
I did a box set of Joy Division in 1997, which is called Heart and Soul. That I was very pleased with, because it had not quite everything, pretty much everything that was good, and also had a live disc, which hadn't been released before. And it wasn't too expensive either, and it had a good booklet. The other compilations I've done tend to be just single CDs. And I think there's an art to doing compilations. It's almost like doing, you know, it's almost like being a curator or doing a personal mixtape. And in fact, that's how the compilations I've done have originated, which is in me doing playlists out of iTunes and sending them to friends and people saying, oh yes, okay, we'll put that out. Friends in record companies. But it's an expression just of having fun with music and like putting, you know, it's almost like being a DJ.
Some box sets, of course, you know, come with extraordinary packaging, don't they? And do you get very involved in that and the ones that you've been involved with?
Well, on the Joy Division set, it was quite simple, really. It was a question of working out the cover. You know, Rob Grutton said, yes, we like this image as a cover, and then deciding to have a booklet and getting Peter Saville and John Wozencroft involved to do the booklet. And then I edited a booklet together, including text by Paul Morley and Jean-Pierre Turmel and discography and lyrics. I don't go for the, particularly for the all singing, all dancing, 3D hologram, you know, all that stuff. It's a bit, it's just a bit naff, really.
I never know where to put them on the shelf.
Well, that's the other thing. Yes.
Karen Simmons, and I am the Managing Director of Universal Music Catalogue Division. And in the Catalogue Division, we find new ways to work music that has been successful in the past. So that could be anything from the creation of a beautiful bespoke box set to a range of CDs that sit in supermarkets and sell at about £2 or £3, and kind of everything in between actually as well. A couple of weeks ago we worked on Nirvana's reissue of Nevermind. It was a celebration of the 20th anniversary of the album. We're also putting a lot of work in into The Who's Quadrophenia at the moment. That's coming out in November. And Pete Townsend has been working on this probably for almost a year now as well. He's written the most astonishing essay, 25,000 words, totally unedited, going out in the book. I think with the box sets, it allows people to do lots of things that you often can't do with a brand new artist album that's coming out, which is exciting in its own way. But this revisiting of a project, it gives you a different way to explore music, I think. There isn't really a bunch of people who sit around a room every Monday morning and think, oh, what should we reissue next? Sometimes the albums seem to choose themselves. Sometimes it's anniversary driven. So, you know, Nirvana being, you know, 20 years old, but the, you know, Quadrophenia is not driven by a particular anniversary. But it felt like an album of The Who's that hadn't really been explored or expanded in a way that it actually deserved to be.
The handmade titles, they're limited edition releases, they're online only, they tend to be a higher price point. So we want to make sure that, you know, if we're going to ask the fans to spend the money on these packages, that we really, really give them something that's worthwhile and oftentimes over the top. And that includes, you know, going searching for, you know, photos, especially photos that maybe haven't been published before. I mean, that's one of our big things, is to try and find as many photos and as we can to include. But for the handmade stuff, we want to actually make the package, have it be something that you can kind of put on your shelf and people will see it like, wow, that's amazing. What is it? And have it almost be the packaging, be part of the art as well as just the music.
We also did a Rufus Wainwright box set recently. Can I show you that? Because it's absolutely amazing. It's this beautiful red velvet with gold gilt writing on the front. And inside is this fabulous book with loads of pictures of Rufus and his family kind of from a young age. I think there's about 19 different CDs in here and various art prints and stuff. And it felt like a great opportunity to kind of draw everything together, not just his studio albums, but he's done a lot of work with different artists, with his family. You know, sometimes stuff appears on soundtracks, and it felt like a really good opportunity to kind of pull it all together and sell it to a very dedicated bunch of fans that Rufus has, really, who I think appreciate his art and, you know, the quality that he brings to things.
The problem with box sets, unless they're really well done, is that they're a bit of a faff. You have to open the packaging, you have to get the CDs out, and if it's a chronological look at a band, then CD 4 is probably going to be useless. You know, the latest CD of the kind of Reformations and whatever. So you don't want that. So there's a lot of chaff there. And often with outtakes, unless it's a group you're really obsessed with, a lot of outtakes are outtakes because for a good reason, in that they weren't good enough to release in the first place. What I'm noticing now with the box sets coming up this autumn, particularly something like the Smile box set, the Beach Boys, there's a real point to that, in which hardly any of it's ever been released, or very little of it's ever been released, and it is great.
I do feel for the fans in some of these things, like the Pink Floyd recently remastered sets, which came out and had a similar format to the one you describe. And people have bought, you know, Dark Side of the Moon probably 5 or 6 times before, and now having to shell out, you know, a lot of money just to get these new formats.
It is a bit cheeky when you get the CD upgrade of the CD upgrade of the CD of the vinyl. The Pink Floyd sets people have complained about. I haven't bought them and probably will not, because I actually don't like the original albums enough. And what everybody wants to hear, obviously, is the Syd Barrett period. And that's exactly what is not being issued. I mean, the idea is to have fun, really. You probably won't sell very much, but it's an attention getter, and you'll get, you know, a reason why it'll probably pay for itself in the amount of press it gets.
So they don't make much money out of them?
No. You know, I personally don't make much money out of them. The problem is, with anything archival now, is that archive has been big business for 20, 25, 30 years. And so all the rights holders are really clued up on how much to ask. And this is why it is very frustrating, and this is why so many people just, you know, stream stuff or put stuff on the net to be downloaded, is that it's actually very frustrating sometimes wanting to get a particular track, and they have unrealistic expectations, or, you know, the rights holder has been on drugs for 30 years and is out of his mind.
We do make money on them, but the way you really make money is selling a lot of a product that's the same. So with the box sets that we've been talking about, they're very, very limited runs, so you don't make a huge amount of money out of those.
Karen Simmons, Mason Williams and John Savage there, speaking to Music Weekly. Let's open this up. What are we box set buyers? Were you box set buyers? Do you get box sets for free? Do you ever play them?
Don't get box sets for free. If you want to give me a box set for free.
I'm not giving you a box set.
Oh, okay. It's funny, recently, the kind of Smile Sessions and the Pink Floyd, you know, those are the albums that were never supposed to kind of come out again in any form, almost. That kind of, the whole mystery that was around those things has kind of gone.
Which, you think it's dissipated a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when you see the kind of colossal effort that's gone into them, you know, obviously you think, you know, this is not for casual buyers. This is for the mega fan who's going to, you know, collect together his pocket money and put it together. But there is something about those things coming out a bit weird. The Smiths is the only stuff I've actually heard. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of proper remastering, because those albums were never remastered properly, really, after their first
Morrissey's complained about them, hasn't he?
Of course he's complained about them, as Morrissey does. But kind of... there's the first Smiths album in particular, and Smith to Smith, you know, not a brilliantly sounding record. It just didn't sound like very good. You know, the kind of sound quality has completely changed to it. I wrote something about 3 or 4 years ago for The Guardian, which I think if you've grown up with a record, it actually sounding more polished and more professional can actually change your feelings towards it. Actually, a bad
weird,
way.
Yeah.
You remember when Kraftwerk reissued their stuff and remastered their stuff, and I was thinking, why doesn't Radioactivity sound a bit kind of weird, like he was, you know, recording it on tape, because it's been, you know, done.
Of course, yeah. No, I mean, Richard, do you think these things are worth the money?
I have to say that for me, there are very few that I'd want to buy. And what I'm always really fascinated by is the idea that you get these things, and then what do you really do with them? Do you really sit and listen to all? I mean, yeah, going through this Acting Baby one, I mean, 6 CDs, 4 DVDs, you know, umpteen stickers and the shades. It's what do you actually sit down and listen to it again and again and again? And I think you'd maybe listen to them once out of curiosity, and I think they can be really interesting. Like the I got the Velvet Underground closet mixes a couple of years ago.
Sounds great.
That was really interesting to hear them in a different way. But really, when I want to listen to it now, I go back to the originals that I've kind of are imprinted.
Yeah, you've had that relationship with them, and almost you know, listening to them all scrubbed up and clean isn't the same.
I mean,
it's interesting. The Beatles albums as well that came out a couple of years
ago.
That's different. Obviously, they were remastered or whatever. But
I mean, I think it's a sort of historical fascination by kind of hearing alternate versions and hearing the you know, when they actually really did start out as different songs and you got that all on tape. That's all really cool. But I just don't know if I'm going to live with that. So I guess for me, forking £175 is a lot of money, and I probably won't be doing it. I'm sorry, Bono.
I wouldn't sit through the 9 DVDs of Acting Baby.
You sat through Pink Floyd, though, didn't you?
I love Pink Floyd, though.
Yeah, but
I'm a massive Pink Floyd fan. Yeah. And, you know, that was a lovely weekend I spent in the company of that box.
But would you do it again?
No, but it's interesting. I think the Pink Floyd ones are particularly interesting in that they've always been very, you know, as Pink Floyd are, reserved and guarded about releasing anything. I think in their entire career, you know, they've released sort of 3 previously unreleased tracks and a live album, and that's it. And it is kind of amazing to hear, you know, a record like Dark Side of the Moon. You do, if you're willing to shell out all the cash for the 5-disc or whatever it is box set, you do get to hear these kind of demo versions. You do get to hear these, you know, tracks that didn't make it onto the album. You get to hear what they tried to do next before they settled on. And, you know, the question is this curating an important piece of 20th century art in the way one should be created, you know, with the respect, and or is it just trying to squeeze as much money out of diehard fans? You know, you're just turning your diehard fans upside down and shaking them until the coins come out of their pockets. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, I think. You know, I think a record like Quadrophenia, it's really interesting in that clearly, I think sort of one of the motivations behind it is that Pete Townsend thinks it's a better album than it is considered to be within the canon of The Who. You know, it's always overshadowed by Tommy and Who's Next.
Right.
And I think it's sort of the box set in a way's attempt to sort of explicate. Explicate? Explain is what I mean. explicate, listen to me.
But a lot of bands have done recently, all the Queen reissues that came out recently, that apparently was motivated by, you know, Brian May and, I think it was mainly Brian May, but I'm not 100% sure, but kind of saying, you know, why are albums that aren't A Night at the Opera not as thought of as highly? Because we've done lots of the other stuff, but it all comes back to, you know, we're the champions and kind of the classic, you know, it comes back to the best of.
Yeah.
But so it's bands of a certain age going, but you know what? We are important and we have done brilliant things, and here we are, and we're
good. Yeah, and you know, I'd rather a band of a certain age were opening their vaults in that way than, say, producing a terrible musical based on their hits. You know what I mean? mentioning their names. I think it's a better way of guarding your band's legacy. So there you go.
On
that bombshell. That's it for the programme today. Thanks for coming in, Jude.
It's all right. Thank you for
pleasure
me.
As ever. I hope your first time was enjoyable, Richard.
Lots
and
of
I
fun.
Hope to see you again. Cheers. Smashing. We're back next Friday. Till then, thanks for listening. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Corley.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.